forces for the first time ever. Your world will be changed and your sorry complacent ass will be kicked. They will also be joined by the Boyds from Montreal and the sensational Wet Stilettos. Join the fun before DOA takes a hiatus as Joe Keithley works on becoming BC's next premier. Visit www.ticketfly.com for tickets. Every night, over 700 youth sleep on Vancouver's streets. This is their story. Death in a Dumpster, the musical, is a true story about homelessness, written, composed, and performed by a cast of street-involved youth actors. Death in a Dumpster opens November 7th at Waterfront Theatre for three performances only. For tickets and information, go to www.deathinadumpster.ca. Death in a Dumpster is presented by Access to Music in association with Directions Youth Services.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Are you tired of listening to the same music day in and day out and want to try something a little different? Well then, how about listening to Asian music? Now, I don't mean it like...
Open Gangnam Style!
Nor like...
She bangs! She bangs! Oh, baby, but she moves! She moves!
I'm talking about a little more like... And a little more like... And also a little more like... And definitely something like... So tune in to Asian Wave 101, playing you the best of Chinese and Korean pop, Wednesdays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. only on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hi there, my name is Brandon.
And my name is Morme.
Do you need help finding yourself?
Do you have questions you're too afraid to ask?
Worry no more, we got your back.
Because we are two university students who have all the answers.
Just kidding.
We'd like to think that.
But what you can do is tune into All Ears at 101.9 FM every second Wednesday at 6 p.m.
to get the best advice that we can offer.
So shoot us an anonymous question
at ask.fm/allearsubc and we'll answer it live on air.
And Honeychild will be all ears.
Tune in every other Sunday from 3 to 4 p.m. for Blood on the Saddle with your host, Dan N., the real authentic country.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
just a big mistake.
Today is Friday, November 6th. I'm Rohit Joseph.
And I'm Megan Devlin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:09 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have our science and tech update with Marco.
We also have our weekly financial update with News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman. Then we have News 101 directors, my interview with Amanda Pitra Hayes, Director of Sustainability for the City of Vancouver.
And following that, we have Leo Coelho's report on the future of education. This week's episode is the first of four, looking at the history of online education and how it impacts post-secondary institutions.
Finally, we have Eva Uguen-Sejens' interview with Clayton Thomas Mueller, a campaigner for the environmental group 350.org about climate welcome demonstrations in Ottawa.
But first, we have some headlines for you today. In campus news, UBC Engineering is aiming for 50% female enrollment by 2020. So the Dean of Applied Science, Mark Parlange, said that two-thirds of the engineering student body are currently men. Parlange stated that there is a need to end the male dominance in the faculty and push for more diverse representation. Elizabeth Croft, Associate Dean of Education for Applied Science, thinks creating opportunities for young women to learn and discover engineering is particularly important. Croft described how she was discouraged from entering engineering because of the cultural myths that surrounded the profession and the lack of women. Croft said, quote, "The biggest influencers of girls are their parents and teachers, but there's a lack of positive influence when it comes to choosing engineering as a career." To reach their goal of 50% female enrollment by 2020, UBC Engineering has created a number of programs in order to raise awareness about the realities of studying and being an engineer. It is the hope through the mentorship program such as the Women in Engineering Club that women will be encouraged to pursue the profession.
In local news, controversial report blames foreign investors for inflating housing costs. A new report by Andy Yan of Bing Tom Architects suggests that Chinese buyers are purchasing the majority of homes in luxury Vancouver neighborhoods. Yan analyzed 172 single-family homes sold over 6 months in Vancouver's most expensive neighborhoods and found that two-thirds of homeowners had non-anglicized Chinese names. However, BC Finance Minister Mike DeJong questions the data and its small sample size, saying, quote, "We've got to be a little bit careful on the conclusions we draw." The question of foreign investor influence on Vancouver's housing market has raised controversy in the past. Mayor Gregor Robertson said of the study, quote, "I'm very concerned with the racist tones that are implied here, and we have to get away from that. We have to deal with this as a housing challenge we have." Yan, who is ethnically Chinese himself, has defended his name-based methodology and expressed doubts over claims of racism. Yan said, quote, "The fact of the matter is that a lot of them tend to be white, and they are using cries of racism in an attempt to shut down the discussion, a civilized, educated discussion on real estate." Yan added that the most surprising part of the study was that 82% of sales involved a mortgage, more than half of which were held by two lenders. Yan concluded, quote, "That was the takeaway, that so much of this stuff is finance. So there is a logic and infrastructure that creates the real estate market that we see in front of us." New mosquito could pose threat in Metro Vancouver. An invasive mosquito able to carry a number of serious diseases has been found in stagnant water in the lower mainland. This is the first sighting of the species in Western Canada, which scientists believe was brought in from the United States due to human action. According to a study published in the Journal of Entomology, the mosquito, quote, "could be a significant threat to the health of humans and domestic animals." Simon Fraser University researchers and Burnaby Pest Control Company Culex Environmental Limited have investigated and collected the larvae of the species discovered in Maple Ridge. Scott McMahon, National Operations Manager at Culex, said, quote, "It's definitely something we want to keep our eye on, and we're going to keep monitoring it further."
And now, in national news, the Liberals to restore long-form census. The new Liberal government is reinstating the census as one of their first acts. Navdeep Bains, the Minister of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development, made the announcement on Parliament Hill saying, quote, "We need good, reliable data." The penalty for refusing to fill out the mandatory questionnaire is yet to be determined. However, Bains noted that 93.5% of the population completed the census last time. Trudeau said of the decision, quote, "We committed to a government that functions based on evidence and facts, and long-form censuses are an important part of making sure we're serving constituents in our communities." The president of the Canadian Council on Social Development called the long-form census Canada's central navigation system and said its return will be a boon for small rural communities that may have been overlooked in the voluntary household survey. So the new census package must be ready to mail out by May 2nd. The mandatory census was cancelled in 2011 by the Conservative government and replaced with a voluntary national household survey. And next, an Alberta MLA will be the first to give birth during her term. NDP MLA Stephanie McLean will be the first sitting MLA to deliver a baby during her term. This history-making issue is raising questions and challenges about childcare in the legislature. McLean said, quote, "This is going to be really new territory for everyone, for the Legislative Assembly." She plans to work as soon as possible after her delivery scheduled next February. With the NDP majority in Alberta, the legislature has become younger and has greater gender parity. The caucus now has parents to 20 children younger than 10. MLA Brandy Payne said, quote, "It seems to be that this is the first time this is being considered, that members, whether they're mothers or fathers, might need support with childcare." A motion passed recently, 56-9 in Alberta, to include childcare spaces in new government buildings. And next, an old video of an exchange between Trudeau Sr. and the new Justice Minister's father surfaces. At the 1983 Constitutional Conference on Native Issues, then Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau was filmed speaking with First Nations leader Bill Wilson. In the video, Wilson told Trudeau, quote, "I have two children in Vancouver Island, both of whom, for some misguided reason, say they want to be a lawyer, both of whom want to be prime minister." Wilson then added, "both of whom, prime minister, are women." Trudeau had responded, quote, "Tell them I'll stick around until they're ready." 32 years later, Wilson's daughter, Jody Wilson-Raybould, was recently sworn in as Canada's justice minister under the new prime minister, Justin Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau's son. Wilson said he remembered the incident like yesterday. At the time of the exchange, Jody Wilson-Raybould was 12, watching the scene on television. On his daughter's hope of becoming the first Aboriginal prime minister, Wilson said, quote, "She's as close as anyone's ever got." Wilson said seeing his daughter, Jody, appointed justice minister 3 decades later by Pierre's son is, quote, "karma or kismet." Wilson added, quote, "I was worried my daughter might end up in the A-hole cabinet, which is Indian Affairs, and be absolutely useless. I'm obviously very pleased."
In international news, Russia has suspended all flights to Egypt as the investigation into the Sinai plane crash continues. Russia's President Vladimir Putin ordered the restriction earlier today, according to The Guardian. The restrictions follow after intelligence that a terrorist attack could have been the cause of the Russian plane crash over the Sinai Peninsula on Saturday local time, killing all 224 people on board. Britain suspended flights out of Sharm el-Sheikh earlier this week, causing political tensions between the UK, Egypt, and Russia, according to reports from the Middle East Eye and BBC. Planes have begun bringing back UK tourists as of today, but Egypt says only 8 of the 29 flights planned for Friday will operate. Earlier this morning, the BBC reported that UK Security Service investigators believe that a bomb was put into the luggage hold prior to takeoff. These investigators suspected that someone with access to the aircraft's baggage compartment inserted an explosive device inside or on top of the luggage just before takeoff. A branch of the Islamic State's network in the Sinai Peninsula claimed responsibility for bringing the plane down just hours after the crash. However, Russian and Egyptian officials have said that the claim was not credible. Both of the plane's black boxes have been recovered in the investigation. Egyptian and Russian officials said that it was too early to conclude the cause of the crash, and the investigation continues. Oklahoma mayor urged to resign over husband's controversial Halloween costume. Teresa Sharp, mayor of Lahoma, Oklahoma, is being asked to resign after her husband and friends dressed up as the KKK and set fire to a cross on Halloween. Lahoma has apologized and distanced herself from the actions of her husband, Carrie Sharp, saying, quote, "It was poor judgment on the part of him and his friends. I was not involved. I was trick-or-treating. I went trick-or-treating with my child. Myself and the city do not endorse the behavior that was reflected that night." When neighbors saw the gathering, they called the Garfield County Sheriff's Office. However, no charges were filed against the group. County Sheriff Jerry Niles told Enid News that the incident was, quote, "a Halloween prank gone bad." Sharp has apologized for his actions, saying, quote, "I'm very sorry that this happened. I have huge regrets. Trust me." However, he told Enid News, quote, "This is ridiculous, really. It was Halloween night."
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our science and tech update with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco. In our first story, NASA and the European Space Agency's Solar and Heliospheric Observatory showed an unusually fast stream of solar wind and series of shock waves hitting the Earth this week. This created a lot of auroras and polar geomagnetic storms. The victim of all this was Sweden. Flights disappeared from radar screens and the flight control system was grounded, grounding planes as well. Aviation officials say solar storms knocked out the air traffic control system in Sweden Wednesday, prompting them to close the country's airspace for several hours. The solar storm created disturbances in the Earth's magnetic field, which affected radar installations in southern Sweden. No such problems were reported in neighboring countries, though. Agency spokesman Peter Forsberg said, quote, "Flights disappeared from radar screens in Swedish air traffic control towers during the blackout." Forsberg also said it was unclear why the impact was so severe. He said, and quote, "We're working on sorting out the delays. We can't examine the cause right now, but we will soon." In our next story, this involves genetically modified food. Genetically modified pigs are raising concerns about food regulations. Two kinds of genetically modified pigs are on their way to becoming pork on our dinner plates. If they'll do, they'll be some of the very first genetically modified animals, or GMOs, to enter our food system, along with genetically modified salmon that is also trying to gain regulatory approval. Consumers, though, are wary and lack confidence in the government's readiness to regulate a new class of food product. Researchers now are working on two types of modifications. One will develop a pig that is resistant to the African swine fever. This is a devastating disease with no vaccine or cure, and it has led this year to the slaughter of hundreds of pigs in Europe. The other modification is something called a double muscle pig. It produces twice as much muscle as a regular pig, resulting in higher protein and lower pork fat. One of the concerns that critics have, these are the scientists, about transgenic organisms is the possibility that they can introduce new allergens into the food supply via a protein that is not normally found in organisms we eat. But the public is concerned about the public has a general aversion to genetic modification and they're willing to pay more. This is because they are worried about government testing. Health Canada doesn't do its own testing of the foods and instead relies on data generated by companies. This data is kept secret and all the methods are kept secret and there is no labeling. So stay tuned for an update on this story in the coming weeks. In our next story, the International Space Station marks 15 years in space. I have 15 facts, but the most, the weirdest fact is they have to recycle their water. That means they have to get water from washing, human urine, and sweat. So far, 10,000 kilograms of drinkable water has been generated from the crew members' urine. That's one of the facts. Another one is they travel at 28,000 kilometers per hour, so they go around the Earth every 90 minutes. So they see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets a day. In this next story, it's titled, How to Erase Your Ex from Your Life Online. How would you like to erase your ex like they were never part of your life? Online, at least. Several online tools are now available that will let you delete your ex's digital presence from your life. Google is introducing one of these apps and allows you to hide this ex in your digital photo collection. It makes photos that feature this individual no longer visible. One of the software products are called Block Your Ex, and another one is called KillSwitchApp.com. It targets Facebook and allows you to put in an ex-friend and untag any of the photos that you have had with them. In our next story, neuromarketing. Marketers scan consumers' brains to test their ad. Marketers would love to know what's going on inside your head when you watch commercials or when you watch TV. Now there's a new technique called neuromarketing. BrainSights, which is a Toronto company, specializes in scanning people's brainwaves to see if they are responding to a company's messages and content, whether they are emotionally engaged or whether they remember any of it. The information isn't easy to get from traditional marketing focus groups and because people aren't very good at reporting when they're paying attention. Rogers Communication is one of the companies that is using this new service. In their tests, they recruited and paid 150 people to watch hockey in bars in Toronto while wearing the wireless headsets. And they took electroencephalograms, EEGs, scans of their brains. They measured the electric activity in the brain and recorded it on a second-to-second basis. So they are trying to develop marketing tools by scanning your brain to give people what they want in their TV shows. This is Marco. You have been listening to The Science Report.
Thank you, Marco. Now we have our weekly financial update with News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. China resumes IPO activity. Chevron plans to cut 10% of its workforce. Quebec takes a stake in Bombardier. China passes Canada to become the largest U.S. trading partner. New leadership is in store for Sears Canada. And iPhone sales boost Apple's bottom line. We begin today's news with China's security regulators making an announcement stating that it would allow the resumption of initial public offerings in China. This effectively lifts a suspension put into place last July as officials move to combat China's stock market crash that began to surface last spring. The Chinese Security Regulators Commission said that 28 companies which had already seen their pre-approved list halted by the freeze would be the first out of the gate, adding that they have 2 weeks to prepare for a resumption, with the first batch of 10 companies launching after November 20th. The announcement comes after signs that the Chinese stock market has finally stabilized after a rocky summer. The Shanghai Stock Exchange posted its best weekly performance since June, and mainland stock indexes are up by more than 20% since the bottom of the crash in August. Chevron plans to cut up to 7,000 jobs as oil prices continue to slump. The second largest U.S.-based oil producer slashed its 2016 capital budget by 25% and said that it would lay off approximately 10% of its workforce in one of the most dramatic reactions to date to the plunge in crude prices. The California-based company said that it would lay off approximately 6,000 to 7,000 workers, part of the cuts. Chevron posted a sharp drop in quarterly profits, yet still beat Wall Street's expectations due to cost cuts and strong refining margins. According to Thomson Reuters, the company beat analyst expectations, posting a net income of $2.04 billion. However, this is a sharp decline compared to last year, when the company posted a net income of $5.59 billion. Chevron cut operating and administrative expenses by 7% during the quarter, but it was not enough to fully offset the drop in oil prices over the past year. The price of Brent, the benchmark crude used by most of the world, declined by half since June 2014 to an average of $51.30 during the July to September period. Shares for Chevron were down today, closing at $94.03 with a 0.55% decline. Quebec takes stake as Bombardier's woes continue. Bombardier posted a loss of $4.9 billion U.S. in the third quarter because of write-downs to its C-Series and Learjet 85 aircraft programs. The company also announced that the Quebec government will be taking a 49% stake in the C-Series program to get the project over the finish line. The Montreal-based company announced that the province of Quebec will invest $1.3 billion U.S. in the C-Series, which is about 2 years behind schedule. The Quebec government is committed to the project for at least 20 years. The $4.9 billion U.S. net loss, which amounts to $2.20 per share, includes a $3.2 billion write-down related to the C-Series program. The loss also includes a $1.2 billion U.S. charge related to the Learjet 85 program. In addition to working on the sale of minority stake in its railway division, which analysts estimates would bring in $1 to $2 billion, the company is also considering other strategic options, including the sale of non-core assets and exploring ways to trim costs to other programs like the Q400 turboprop aircraft. Shares in Bombardier closed today at $1.52 for a loss of 0.65% for the day. It's official, China passes Canada to become one of the largest U.S. trading partners. BNN and the Globe and Mail reported this morning that China has officially displaced Canada as the United States' largest trading partner, a landmark shift that eliminates one of the defining characteristics of the Canadian economy. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, China's trade with the United States from January 2015 to the end of September 2015 was valued at $4.41 billion U.S., or 17.4% of total U.S. trade. Canada's trade with the United States over the same period amounted to $438 billion, which was 15.3% of total U.S. trade. This is in due part due to a crash in the oil prices and a reduced value of Canadian exports south of the border, which are currently down 11.6% from the same time last year. New leadership is in store for the Canadian retailer Sears. Sears Canada Inc. has hired Kerry Kirkman, a veteran of the Canadian retail industry, to be its president and chief merchant. The move was made by Sears to restore shopper confidence in the struggling department store operator. Kirkland has most recently been the interim president of the shoe retailer Nine West Canada and was a president of Jones Apparel Group from October 2010 until last April. She will replace departing CEO Ronald Bohr, who was with the company for less than 1 year's time. Bohr was the third president to leave the company suddenly in recent years, following Douglas Campbell in September 2014 and Calvin McDonald in September 2013. The company said Tuesday that it's adopted a different management structure to take advantage of Kirkman's experience in merchandising. Sears Canada Inc.'s stock closed today at $10.70 for a gain of 3.78%. Apple's revenue jumps 22% as iPhone sales surge. Apple Inc. reported higher than expected quarterly revenue and profits as sales of the iPhones continue to rise. This has been driven by the launch of the 6S and 6S Plus models last month. The world's largest company by market value said on Tuesday that it sold about 48 million iPhones in the fourth quarter. Apple's sales in China have nearly doubled over the last year to $12.52 billion, accounting for nearly a quarter of its total revenue. Apple's net income has also risen to $11.12 billion, or $1.69 per share, up from $8.4 billion, or $1.42 per share, last year. Shares for Apple were up today, closing at $121.06, with a 0.12% gain. In other market news, Toronto's S&P-TSX Composite Index fell 0.04% to close at 13,553. The broader S&P 500 Index stayed relatively flat today, posting a loss of 0.03% to close at 2,099. The Nasdaq closed higher today with a gain of 0.38%, while in the European markets, the German DAX closed up 0.92%. In the Asian indices, markets stayed relatively flat as the Japanese Nikkei posted a gain of 0.78%, while the Shanghai Composite Index gained 1.91%. In the commodities market, December gold futures were down today 1.39% to close at $1,088 an ounce, while December crude futures were also down 2.01% to close at $44.29 a barrel. In natural gas, December future contracts were up 0.3% to close at $2.37 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds were currently at 1.715%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed higher today with rates at 2.325%. This has been the weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. Now we have News 101 Director Rohit Joseph's interview with the City of Vancouver's Director of Sustainability, Amanda Petra-Hayes. Rohit spoke with Amanda about the progress of Vancouver's Greenest City Action Plan and the challenges that lie ahead.
And we'll get to it right now. First of all, though, let's get you to introduce yourself to the listeners of CITR.
I'm Amanda Petra-Hayes. I'm the Director of Sustainability with the City of Vancouver.
So we're aiming to be the greenest city in the world by 2020. Is there a particular standard or measurement?
There are a multitude of them. One we pay close attention to is the Economist's Green City Index, and we ranked second in North America on that index the last time they held it. But other organizations also have their own Green City rankings. We were ranked first by the World Wildlife Fund in 2013 and then first in North America again this past year for our work. So we want to make sure that being the greenest city is by whatever emerging standards come forward. And so we continue to pay attention to new standards as they emerge.
Throughout your report, there was a lot of milestones that seem to have been mentioned and that have been achieved since we first started embarking on this plan as a city. So which of these milestones do you think represents like the biggest success or represents just how far we've come since we started?
Well, the one we pay the most attention to is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because that, I mean, if we're not paying attention to climate change, then we're missing the boat. And so we're proud of our 7% reduction since our baseline year of 2007. It means that we as a city met the Kyoto Accord, even without federal support. So we're proud of that. But to get to our 2020 and certainly to our 2050 goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions 80%, there's still a lot of work to be done on that front.
You had mentioned reducing the ecological footprint of the city is the hardest or possibly the hardest challenge that we face. Why is that? What makes it particularly challenging?
Bill Reese, who's with UBC, is the pioneer on ecological footprint measurement. And it's really important because when we look at carbon measurement, it's a very limited view of our actual impact. Ecological footprint looks more holistically at our consumption and the impact that that has. And we know that that's, you know, three or four times our impact if we just look at a narrow view of carbon measurement. So it's really important. I think Bill Reese's methodology is kind of a leading standard out there in terms of being able to measure our actual impact, and we're happy that the long-form census is being reinstated, so we might actually be able to measure Vancouver's progress over time.
Will that be? Will the long-form census be like reinstated in time for this massive data collection, though, or will that be suffering through some bureaucracy hurdles and stuff like that?
Yeah, Trudeau reaffirmed his promise yesterday to reinstate the long-form census. And it's important because half of our ecological footprint is our food choices. And so we need that local food consumption data to be able to measure our improvement over time on reducing ecological footprint.
What can help improve, more affordable access to local food? This was mentioned during the meetings, but could you specify maybe what are the steps that the city needs to take to make sure people of all income levels can be guaranteed access to local food?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's supply and demand. And so the more that we can create space for urban agriculture and urban farming and support and educate people about opportunities that there are to have a community garden and to grow their own food, I think the more we can work on the equity issues. We certainly have some enterprising urban farming organizations in Vancouver. Soul Food Farm is a great example of an organization that's creating low-barrier jobs for people to work in an urban farm and have access to local food, which is important because obviously we want to make sure that everyone's included in such an important goal.
So what's the likelihood that a UBC Broadway line will actually come about? We've heard about like the essential, that it's essential to get one just to Arbutus, but us UBC students are still hoping that we can get this extended to our to our campus, where there's a ton of traffic on the 99B line every day that we have to deal with just to get to school. So yeah, any comments on that front? And it seems like it definitely overlaps with some of the Greenest City Action Plan goals.
Yeah, the Broadway SkyTrain is a priority. Our plan is to have it underway before 2020. And certainly now that we have a more supportive federal government for a lot of the work that we're doing, we're looking forward to collaborating with them for funding opportunities to make sure that we're able to extend the Broadway line not just to Arbutus, but potentially further. Access to alternative transportation is essential to keep our growing city vibrant.
All right. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Thank you.
And thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments right here on News 101.
Mark your calendars. Discorder Magazine's fall fundraiser is around the corner. Wander out of your multi-week post-Halloween stupor and directly into the Astoria this November 19th for live performances by Revered, TV Ugly, Mesa Luna, and Late Spring. DJ Danny Vancouver will have all night sets in between the bands. With doors opening at 8, tickets are only $5 at the door before 10 p.m. and $10 after. Proceeds go towards supporting Vancouver's longest-running independent music magazine. Discorder needs your help to stay in print, so come on out for a night of sweet tunes and keep alt coverage of Vancouver and Canadian music, arts, and culture alive. Visit www.discorder.ca for all the details.
Let me refresh your memory. Russians. That's right. Russians. Ruskies. Communists. Communists. Oh, now you remember.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Russian Tim, and I'm the host of weekly punk rock radio show called Rocket from Russia. Every Tuesday, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m., Rocket from Russia is aired on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, or CITR.ca, anywhere where internet is paid for.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Leonardo Coelho's Education Report.
Have you ever imagined yourself in a class with no teacher?
Better.
Are you ready to be taught by a robot? Try imagine yourself in that scenario. Then think, how would you feel? Ready, comfortable, happy, excited, hyped, frustrated, confused, don't have an answer? No problem. Let's talk about education. You've certainly heard about online education. You probably have taken a course. Online courses have been around for 30 years. Education has been positively impacted by the invention of the internet, which has been around since the 1960s. Public internet, like we know, since 1989. Primary, secondary, and tertiary schools are finding ways to reintroduce students to online discussions, communities, and resources. So it's no surprise that online courses became popular. Professors and students embraced the format. Yes, so maybe you've taken an online course before. No matter how you felt about the experience, it's unlikely you witnessed the complete range of the online education style. A group of students at Simon Fraser University developed a website to address the future of higher education and the potential university of the future. According to the page called FightForEducationsFuture.com, the role of professors is being challenged by the proliferation of massive open online courses, commonly known as MOOCs. News 101 spoke with Linda Harrison, a professor at Simon Fraser University's School of Communications, who is a pioneer and a leading researcher in regards to online education. She explains what the MOOCs are and how they threaten professors and students.
In the last 3 years, there's been a new entrant to the field of online education. And this started in the fall of 2011, but since 2012, it's become a huge phenomenon. That's the phenomenon called MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses. And in the United States, it has become viewed by the media, at least, as the best thing since sliced bread. In fact, New York Times was so excited that they called 2012 the year of the MOOC. Based on very little data, I mean, it was only a couple of courses from Stanford University. Nonetheless, there was big waves were made by the media, and it caught a lot of people's attention. It caught the attention of Silicon Valley investors. And while Stanford did two MOOC courses in the fall, by February of 2012, less than 4 months later, the first for-profit MOOC company was incorporated, Udacity. And then within another month, you had Coursera, another for-profit that was opened by Stanford professors of artificial intelligence. And then that spring, you had edX, which was a coalition by Harvard University and MIT to create MOOCs. Not necessarily for profit, but certainly they want to get in on the game and they want to be part of the dominating force.
She also explains how MOOCs differ from traditional online education and their consequences.
The biggest thing is they replace teachers. There's no teachers in a MOOC, only artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence sends out short little video lectures that have been done by professors as consultants or by actors as consultants of the content. And then, so it sends out content and follows up with a quiz, content plus quiz. And as a result, they can have courses with 100,000 students, 500,000 students, because everyone is just getting this little package of video lecture plus quiz. And artificial intelligence is grading it all. So there's no real learning. The students are simply asked to memorize the content and then repeat it on the quiz. How does that make education? It reduces education from thinking and understanding to simply memorizing and repeating. In a way, you turn the students into the robot. At the same time that artificial intelligence, scientists are trying to turn robots into humans, into human brains. So we have a really serious challenge.
In 2012, UBC and Coursera announced a partnership to provide free non-credit courses to a worldwide audience in MOOC format. Their first MOOC, Game Theory, drew 130,000 registrants from all Canadian provinces and several countries. The main critique about MOOCs is that the completion rate is below 5%. No university would survive if a 2 or 4% graduated or even completed a course. However, MOOCs have to be taken seriously because the investors are not giving up. They are putting millions of dollars into market. Brandon Lane studies interactive arts and technology at SFU and is one of the founding members of FightForEducationsFutures.com. He believes professors and engaged students belong to each other, and he doesn't want to see a robotic world. For him, the MOOC is a step back to the old days.
From what I can tell about this MOOC, it's very much this old school lecture style of education where a lot of information is kind of just presented and you as a student are asked to take that information and to internalize it and then repeat it back on quizzes and exams. And this, you know, this education style style is nothing new. It's been around for a long time. It's used in lecture halls in universities and a lot of places. But the difference with the MOOC is that the MOOC is, as far as I know, a very highly funded thing. You know, unlike this lecture hall, which seems kind of like a boring, stodgy thing, the MOOC has actually got millions of dollars of investment behind it. People are getting behind it. And there really isn't a need for a professor. What we've come to realize with the MOOC is that because it's so, dare I say, robotic in its delivery of material, you can get a professor to record videos, post some information, and then a computer can take care of delivering that to a student at whatever pace they need it. And so it really removes the need for anybody who needs to moderate discussions or group work. None of that becomes important if the only delivery method and the only necessity is this transmission of information from the computer to the student.
Fourth-year communication student Pamela Kimberly shares the concern.
The concept of the MOOC and the pedagogy that it promotes, standardization of education and that sort of way of learning, should I say memorization rather than learning, that's something we're seeing now. Teachers are out of work, and that's because they're producing content that can be taken over by machines, essentially. So we are seeing that now. It might not just affect our future.
That's our segment for today. Next week, we will be talking if online education can foster critical and collaborative thinking instead of just memorization. On the background, you heard Bad Bad Not Good with the track Flashing Lights. We'll see you next week. For News 101, I'm Leonardo.
Thank you, Leo. For our last story of the evening, we have Eva Yuguen Senge's interview with the environmental group C350.
Thomas Mueller. I'm the Stop It at the Source campaigner with 350.org. We're a global climate change organization investing in building a true global movement for climate justice.
Can you start by telling us a bit about this week's campaign and what you'll be doing in Ottawa?
The message that we're sending out to Canadians and First Nations and everyone in between is that, you know, I think we can all breathe a sigh of relief that, you know, we've gotten rid of 11 years of a conservative majority government led by Stephen Harper. The cost of that 11 years has been devastating, I think, to all social movements. And, you know, the message that we're coming into Climate Welcome here in Ottawa on November 5th through the 8th is, you know, we're showing up at 24 Sussex, the home of Canada's new Prime Minister-elect Trudeau, to be very clear that, you know, we have a very serious but firm and gentle message invoking the spirit of civil disobedience from the civil rights era and sending a message that, you know, essentially, you know, the policies that Trudeau got elected with set Canada on a collision course, the collision course over its lack of clarity on, you know, support of expanding the Canadian tar sands and the building of tar sands pipeline, while committing to, you know, repairing Canada's image at the UN Paris climate talks, and at the same time setting Canada on a trajectory of a collision course with its First Nations because of the fact that its economic policies are, you know, relatively similar to Prime Minister Harper's government's policies. And so we have a lot of questions, and there's a lot of messages from concerned community members who are concerned about their local water sources that are being threatened by pipelines, from First Nations who are concerned about the expansion of the tar sands in northern Alberta, and concerns from people all over the world about Canada's role in the global climate crisis, producing a controversial, dirty source of fossil fuel like the tar sands. So, you know, coming into Climate Welcome, we have 4 days of peaceful sit-ins that we're going to be organizing there at 24 Sussex. Each day we'll be presenting gifts to the new Prime Minister and his government, representing all of these messages that I'm describing. And there will be an act of civil disobedience. We'll be conducting peaceful sit-ins where citizens will risk arrest to show how very serious we are that Canada needs to get the record straight on climate change and freeze tar sands expansion.
24 Sussex has been in the news a lot lately because of the planned renovations and the fact that the Prime Minister-elect and his family won't be moving in right away. How have you adjusted to that?
Well, for the listeners that aren't familiar with the capital region, the residents actually that Prime Minister-elect Trudeau and his family are going to be staying in are actually just right behind 24 Sussex across the street at the residence of the Governor General of Canada. And so, you know, we're proceeding ahead as planned. We'll be delivering solar panels, a full photo array of solar panels, Canadian made, that he can incorporate into his renovations there at 24 Sussex. So, you know, we've definitely calculated everything.
The tone of this campaign is definitely interesting. You use a lot of words like climate welcome and sending gifts, and you're asking people who participate to dress in semi-formal attire as if they were attending an interview. What's the intention behind that?
One of the things, like I said, is we want to certainly, I think we share the excitement that all voters who got rid of Harper share, and that we're excited about the new government. We're excited that they could do the right thing by freezing tar sands expansion and by unthawing the renewable energy economy here in our country. You know, as I mentioned, there's a lot of tensions between some of the electoral platform promises that Mr. Trudeau made, particularly on going to Paris without clarifying Canada's emissions targets, you know, the collision course that Canada's economic policies place it on with the rights of First Nations peoples. There's a lot of clear gaps that need to be filled in with action strategies. And, you know, it's a life and death circumstance for people certainly across the planet dealing with climate change, for First Nations on the front line dealing with the expansion of the tar sands and, you know, cancer clusters in their communities. It's a concern of Canadians who lost protection of their water resources in lakes, rivers, and streams all across the country that are threatened by tar sands pipelines. And so, you know, for us, we're coming in with a very serious message, and you know, and that message is that Mr. Trudeau has to clarify what his plans are and explain to the country how he is going to set Canada's record straight when it comes to climate change, and certainly when it comes to the rights of locally affected communities.
Part of the Liberal platform was a pledge for to a nation-to-nation relationship between the government of Canada and Indigenous peoples. How would you define that, a nation-to-nation relationship?
Canada's got a long way to go when it comes to reconciliation with its First Nations people. And I think that certainly the trade agreements that Prime Minister-elect Trudeau has supported that came through the Harper era, you know, continue to, you know, set the stage in terms of business as usual when it comes to Canada's extractive industries-based economy. And this puts immense pressure on Indigenous peoples in places like the tar sands that have to deal with, you know, mega extraction on a mega level and that are doubly impacted, you know, with the impact of climate change and other socioeconomic factors that spiral out of this type of development. And, you know, I think that for us, right off the bat, you know, Prime Minister-elect Trudeau and his government needs to, you know, ratify the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and not in the way that, you know, he said he would, you know, by interpreting, you know, Canada's domestic Aboriginal laws and really looking at it as more of an aspirational document. That is just not adequate, considering that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, of course, represents simply the mere minimum standard of a domestic Indigenous rights policy that can always be strengthened. And I think that that's what's important for people to understand, is that, you know, this government, you know, I think we, like I said, we're all very pleased that, you know, Mr. Trudeau is committed to the inquiry for murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. You know, I think that the commitment that we see, especially on today with the Truth and Reconciliation Center opening here in the Capital Region, you know, there is, I think, good spirit all abound, you know, in terms of there being space in the political realm, you know, for real, tangible conversations around reconciliation. But I think that, you know, when we look at the dark underbelly of Canada's extractive economies and the way that that plays out in a socioeconomic sense for First Nations peoples living with this type of development in their lands, the impacts are very disproportionate. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we have such strong leadership from impacted communities, from various pipeline fights, from the tar sands, you know, from coast to coast, coming to the action to participate, because, you know, I think people want to send a very, like I said, strong message that, you know, here's a chance for the new young prime minister-elect to get it right and to really take Canada into a new economic paradigm that doesn't force citizens to choose between putting food on the table and sacrificing certain communities. So.
Well, thank you very much, Clayton. I really appreciate you taking the time, and thank you on behalf of CITR as well.
Thank you, Eva. That's our program for today, November 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news/news101. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Rohith Joseph.
And I'm Megan Devlin. Today's broadcast was produced by Leonardo Coelho and Eva Yuguen Senge. For the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have QC by TV Ugly.